climate change, the events that we have today are happening partially because industry failed to act back in the 50s. In those moments, if they started to say, oof, like this is not a product that we can morally sell and started to phase out, then the world that we look in would look very different.
Welcome to Cambridge Forum. I'm Mary Stack, and today we're going to examine one of the most pressing issues confronting us at this time, climate change and the survival of the planet. Today, New Zealand is dealing with yet another cyclone and has declared a state of emergency. These climatic disasters are becoming such everyday events, we lose track of the names of the hurricanes and the dates. But to fully understand how we got into this pitiful predicament, we really need to rewind the clock and look back at events to see what we now know for certain. Thanks to the diligent work of Harvard researchers like Jeffrey Supan and Naomi Oreskes, whose recent science paper was picked up by the world media, to quote Supan, we now have airtight, unimpeachable evidence that ExxonMobil accurately predicted global warming years before it turned around, publicly attacked climate science and scientists. Its public denial contradicted its own scientists' data. But of course, we knew this decades before. Back in 1959, renowned physicist Edward Teller warned oil executives about the dangerous impact that fossil fuels would have on global temperatures, citing melting ice caps, rising oceans, and large-scale environmental destruction. His speech was followed by ExxonMobil's own scientific data in the 70s, which shows their projections of global temperature increases matched what has actually occurred with remarkable accuracy. Well, it's all very depressing since it demonstrates ever so clearly that ExxonMobil knew all this and how we could have avoided the predicament we find ourselves now. Well, we have three very capable experts in their fields. We're going to consider the legal options that are being pursued to prosecute the oil companies who have spent millions of dollars trying to convince people that the climate emergency wasn't real. We're going to talk to journalist Jeff Dembicki. He's written a remarkable account of this blighted period of history entitled The Petroleum Papers, Inside the Far-Right Conspiracy to Cover Up Climate Change. And he will be joined by Alyssa Joel, VP for Legal for the Center for Climate Integrity, and Dr. Delta Myrner, who's a lead scientist for climate litigation at the Union of Concerned Scientists. So, okay, let's go across to Delta. Welcome, Delta. So you're in a sort of brand new area of science, climate litigation. How far have you guys been able to come to link climate events to and increases in global warming, warming back to the cause being fossil fuels?
Yeah, so I'm excited to dig into that research. So yeah, I work on what I call litigation relevant research. And to be clear, climate litigation relevant research can take a lot of different forms. So in fact, I worked on two publications this past year that helped to outline and prioritize research needs in this really emerging area of work. So broadly, this work helps us to understand how litigators are thinking about scientific input in their work. And we found that there's need for research in the natural sciences, the social sciences, legal analysis, translational work. There's a number of different fields that are required to really inform these discussions in a meaningful way, because climate change is incredibly complex. And the impacts are complex, but are understood and can be understood scientifically. So through that process, we identified nearly 100 specific research questions that legal teams have right now and that, you know, scientists need to engage in to really drive this field. We did further analysis and we helped to prioritize those areas. And the main areas of work that are needed are around climate attribution science, climate obstruction work, which is what Alyssa was really talking about and what Jeff's book really highlights. And then also research to help better assess emission reductions. So that gets at kind of that other question you had of like, how do the courts grapple with what emission reductions really look like? And there's need for science around that. But to your specific question, I want to talk about how to link climate impacts to kind of events and then to specific industry. So to link climate impacts, such as the typhoon that was highlighted in petroleum papers, to carbon producers themselves, to the oil and gas producers, we need to look at a field of science that's called attribution science. And attribution science, what it does is it helps to answer the question, did climate change play a role in that? So climate attribution has been around for about 2 decades, which is an incredibly new science. You know, that's a very new field, but there's been really important advances that have happened over the last 5 years. Now, with attribution science, and this is how we kind of get at these connections, there's really 2 areas of attribution science. So there's event attribution and there's source attribution. So I want to start with event attribution, and then I'll talk a little bit about source. But with event attribution, that can tell us kind of how climate change has added to the severity of a particular event. So it's about understanding the role of climate change versus natural weather patterns or random climate variability. So these types of studies can tell us how much hotter a heat wave is or how much greater intensity the downpour during a hurricane might be because of climate change specifically. Attribution science can also help us understand the compound impacts that happen during climate change. So for example, during a hurricane is its dynamics itself are changed because of climate change, but the impacts are also changed because of sea level rise. And through attribution science, we can take these different pieces and understand them all kind of in their individual aspects and understand the role that climate change played in each of those, right? So event attribution helps us understand the role of climate change. And now source attribution science can help us identify the role of specific emission sources. So this gets at some of those corporate questions that you're asking. So this work kind of on the source attribution really started back in 2013 with a publication by Richard Heaty, which found that nearly 2/3 of all industrial carbon emissions from the Industrial Revolution onwards can be traced to just 90 fossil fuel and cement producers. So these companies, which we commonly call the carbon majors, include ExxonMobil, BP, Chevron, Shell, just to name a few, right? And kind of from that data set, we've been able to do a number of other studies that look at climate events, that look at a number of different impacts from climate change, and can do the attribution study to understand kind of the role of climate change in that, and then look at the role of industry. So some of my colleagues at the Union of Concerned Scientists have published around source attribution, and they have found that these carbon producers contributed to about 42 to 50% of all global temperature rise. So again, this is just less than 100 companies that are responsible for this or who tie to this. We also know that upwards of 32% of global sea level rise is tied to these companies, and that nearly half of all ocean acidification. So again, this is a really new science, but it's emerging rapidly and growing in really exciting ways. And we're starting to kind of get new impacts and understand this at different levels. I think what's amazing about this is we often get caught in thinking of climate change as something that's global, that's abstract, it's hard to address. And this is part of, you know, what we hear and what the industry wants us to think about it. But there you can see through the science that there's clear connections between climate change and specific actors.
Well, that was a very good explanation of the difficulties involved. So my question is, how far back do you go in terms of linking cause and effect? And then how do you quantify that?
Yeah, so most of these models that currently exist look at from the Industrial Revolution. So they're starting to look at from when industry started to pollute, right? And when carbon started to be produced on a mass scale. But then the more recent studies break it down kind of based on the same type of research that you're seeing, based on the social science research, the historical archives, to say, okay, from 65, when, you know, we can say with certainty that the industry understood the consequences of their products in this space, what has happened since then? So you can break it down by a number of different timeframes, right? And as the research improves and likely as discovery moves forward in some of the cases, if that date moves backwards, then you can continue to shift the analysis to address that, to understand what the contributions have been for carbon in that time period. And then you can kind of do the source attribution to understand how that impacts different events. Now, the question that you ask moving forward and what that looks like is really important, and it is a super interdisciplinary space to think about, right? Because climate change, the events that we have today are only happening because industry, or maybe not only, but are happening partially because industry failed to act back in the 50s. In those moments, if they started to say, oof, like this is not a product that we can morally sell, and started to phase out, then the world that we look in would look very different. So it's not as simple as saying, okay, what percentage of these impacts are caused from your carbon produce? You know, there's also the impacts of how the world might have looked differently if you didn't have all this greenwashing, if you weren't producing this obstruction of the science, if you weren't putting out all these campaigns to create disinformation and prevent policies from happening. So those all need to start to be factored in into that conversation as well.
There's going to be an awful lot of lawyers being involved in this for a long time to come. So what about taking countries now? We've talked about certain climate action cases in the United States. What about the country like the Philippines, where you said there's actually human rights issues now part of the equation? Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah. So in the international cases, at least that I've been involved with, the majority of them are actually based around human rights law. And that's the lens that folks are looking at climate change. In the Philippines, the case here, which is really interesting, and there was a Commission of Human Rights of the Philippines, and they conducted an inquiry into the human rights impacts of climate change in the Philippines, really seeking to hold these companies, you know, these carbon majors, accountable for contributing to global emissions of greenhouse gases and the resulting impacts. So that commission, again, this was an inquiry, so they basically put out a report at the end of it, but they were looking at, you know, what are the possibilities for holding these companies accountable? And what they found was that the science was strong enough to link individual companies, groups of companies, to the harms that we're seeing in the Philippines. So I think the report came out last year. Is about a 7-year process of studying this. And that's partially because it was the first of its kind to really examine the role of these oil and gas companies in climate-related human rights violations in this way. And ultimately, they found that the 47 investor-owned corporations that they were specifically looking at, which include Shell, include ExxonMobil, Chevron, BP, Total, so not just kind of the US and UK-based, or I guess Total's in France, but they found that they can be legally and morally liable for human rights harms to Filipinos resulting from climate change. They also found that the relevant criminal intent may exist to hold companies accountable under civil and criminal law. So this goes beyond a lot of the cases that we've seen. And that in light of certain circumstances, that there's potential for legal avenues looking at, you know, the role that these companies played in obstruction and climate denial and how that led to the impacts that we have today. One of the things that I think was really powerful in this report, there's a lot, it's something that's really interesting to read through and look at their findings, but they really talk about kind of the failure to act. So this point that we were just addressing, and they understood that by no later than 1965, these companies understood the harms and the risks of their products. And there's this really powerful line from the findings of the commission that say that these efforts to obstruct climate action were driven not by ignorance, but by greed. So it's a very clear kind of lens on what was happening, right? They can't say they didn't know this was about profits and this was driven by greed.
I went to the Philippines when that inquiry was just getting started. And while I was there, I traveled down to Tacloban City, which had been totally destroyed by Typhoon Haiyan in 2013. It was one of the most powerful storms in human history. And when I was there, I met a woman my age named Joanna. And most of her close family members were killed during that typhoon. And we sat in a coffee shop and she pointed to a water line high up on the ceiling and said, that's how high the storm surge had been when Typhoon Haiyan came through. And so Joanna wasn't someone who before the hurricane ever really thought much about climate change or activism at all. But when environmental groups started coming to Tacloban, she began to learn more and more about the science of climate change, how it had contributed to disasters like Typhoon Haiyan. And then after documents started being released about what oil companies knew about climate change, she saw that in some of these companies' internal communications, they had actually seemed to predict tropical storms getting worse as a result of burning their products. And so now, if you can only imagine this woman, Joanna, she's experienced one of the worst events you could possibly imagine linked to climate change. Now she's starting to realize that inside the research labs of companies like Shell and Exxon, they had known that disasters like this were possible. And instead of transitioning their business models, they did everything they could to increase the climate impact of what they were pulling out of the ground. And so just speaking for myself, that's really when all of this kind of became real to me and what wasn't just, you know, an abstract legal or scientific discussion. There are real human lives that are being affected by decisions made in the corporate boardrooms of oil companies. And Joanna's story is just one out of millions and millions across the entire planet.
You're listening to the 64-year climate change cover-up with Jeff Dembicki, investigative climate change journalist. He's joined by Alyssa Joel, VP Legal for the Center for Climate Integrity, and Delta Myrner, lead scientist for climate litigation at the Union of Concerned Scientists. We've got a lot of questions coming in, and we ought to take some of them. I don't know if you want to field this, Delta. Does your research suggest that the fossil fuel companies shared their internal predictions of impacts with other oil industry companies?
Yeah, so I can talk about this a little bit, and I'm sure Jeff can touch on it more. I think what's important to understand is that these companies are part of industrial groups, right, and lobbying groups. So through the American Petroleum Institute, through API, that's how I guess there's an understanding of the larger knowledge through the industry, because these documents were shared through this lobbying group. So yeah, there was shared knowledge that exists between the groups. And Jeff, I don't know if you want to talk about that more.
Well, that actually led to my publisher and I deciding to have the word conspiracy in the title of my book. And people have asked me since the book came out, can you really call this a conspiracy, or is it responsible to use that word given how many crazy conspiracies are out there these days? But what we can see going through the industry's own documents is that in the 60s, trade associations like the American Petroleum Institute, they wrote reports about climate change, disseminated those to their member companies. And then these same trade associations helped come up with communication strategies for making people doubt climate change was real. And so in that very real sense, these top oil companies did conspire together to bury their own scientific knowledge.
And that is certainly the basis of some of the claims that we're starting to see in these cases. I think the Boulder lawsuit was the first suit to include a conspiracy claim. And more recently with the RICO, the racketeering case that was brought by the Puerto Rican communities, which I don't know, Jeffrey, as you're talking about, you know, the hurricane or the typhoon in Philippines, I mean, reading through the Puerto Rican complaint, I mean, the stories and the impacts and the harm that the suffering that went on in Puerto Rico in the aftermath of Hurricane Maria and the other hurricane that followed shortly after, it was devastating and resulted, I think, in probably close to 4,000 deaths as well. So I think, you know, in terms of putting a price tag on all of this, it's a question that you asked earlier on, Mary. I mean, it's almost impossible to do it. There are ways to go about doing it, and courts are adept at calculating these kinds of damages. But the harm is severe, and it's widespread, and it's only going to get worse.
That term, climate racketeering, that strikes everybody as a strange word to use. You don't think of racketeering Why is it racketeering? Because there were so many people involved in fixing the situation or not fixing? I mean, rigging rather than fixing, solving.
Well, the federal RICO statute came about as a response to and a means to address what was going on with the mafia, very specifically. And it's now been used, I think, against, you know, in this type of litigation, it was used against the tobacco industry. It's been used against the opioid industry and big pharma. And now I think it rightly so that people are looking at this as, you know, a conspiracy. The fact that the American, you know, Petroleum Institute was funding research back in the late 1960s that they then distributed to their members, that they were coming together on a regular basis and coming up with, well, how do we deal with this? What's the response going to be? What does this look like in practice? How do we create the doubt and uncertainty in the minds of Americans? So they're not totally, you know, feel the vitriol when they go to the gas pump. I mean, it was all done with, you know, extraordinary intention, and it was done very effectively and successfully. And, you know, again, the PR firms were instrumental in this, right? I mean, they were selling doubt, they were selling deception, they were selling denial on the part of the industry, and they did it very effectively.
I should note that when the oil companies attempt to respond to these lawsuits, they do everything possible to make climate change seem as abstract and removed from any specific individual or company as possible. There was one line from a lawyer responding to one of these liability lawsuits, and he said something to the effect of, you know, a molecule of carbon travels around the entire planet. You can't possibly trace this to any one person. And so it's in the best interests of the industry to make us all feel that we're equally responsible for this climate emergency, instead of seeing the emergency correctly as a series of opportunities that were deliberately sabotaged by a small handful of companies whose executives have names and addresses and boardrooms that they sit in.
Somebody's asked, what have you found out about the ways in which the fossil fuel companies infiltrated universities and the college curricula?
I think, Jeff, in your book, you talk a little bit about the like Stanford and some of the money that went through through there, if I'm right. But there's certain institutions that and research groups at institutions that have been very much affiliated with fossil fuel. One of the things, I wish I had the stats right in front of me, but there was an article that came out, I believe in Nature, but just in November it was published, and it looked at the role, and this is specifically trying to understand methane, and they looked at the role the fossil fuel industry played in funding research around methane and what the outcomes of that research were. And they see for scientific studies that were done that were funded by industry, they're all much more favorable to industry versus studies that have independent funding that are coming from to them. So I think more and more they're starting to see, and people are starting to pull that apart and really think about where the funding is coming from and what the results of that science are, which is critical.
Oh, and I would just say briefly, the industry doesn't just fund attacks on science. It funds an entire political and social worldview. So if you look at the organizations that Koch Industries has funded, these are quite far-right organizations that are in some cases calling for the abolition of government and pushing this anti-regulatory celebration of individual entrepreneurial spirit that cannot flourish with any sort of government regulations or collective action. And that's been a deliberate attempt by industry to sort of enshrine its attacks against science as being not only common sense, but being, you know, morally and politically right. And we're still living in that world.
Delta, you wrote a very upbeat, if that's not the right word to use, but optimistic piece, three predictions for climate litigation in 2023. So maybe you could speak a little bit about that.
The article that I wrote, yeah, tried to summarize kind of three areas that I'm hoping to see change or predicting to see movement in over the next year. The first is that I do believe that, you know, Exxon, BP, Shell, Chevron, these groups in the companies that are involved in the U.S. litigation, that communities across the nation will start to see their day in court. And as Alyssa mentioned, there's been, these cases have been tied up in these jurisdictional battles, and we are starting to see movement in some of them. And if the industry continues to use, you know, their coffers to, you know, push on these jurisdictional battles, there is space for the Biden administration to step in and to, so I am hopeful that this year we're going to see movement there. I also think that this year we're going to see new and exciting legal approaches to accountability happening across the globe. And so the case that we talked about with Shell and the shareholders is one example of that. But I think that we're going to see innovative greenwashing lawsuits that really dig into some of the environmental claims and the net zero statements of these industries, and that it'll expand beyond just the fossil fuel industries, right? Understanding the role that clothing companies and the auto industry and agribusiness, in addition to big oil, have played in this. I also think we'll see more cases against corporations. So globally, the majority of the cases have been against governments. And I think we're going to see a lot more around corporate actors that are happening kind of across the world. And part of that, you know, that I think will shift that landscape is this exciting moment that we're at, where the International Court of Justice is preparing to vote on an advisory opinion on climate change. And this is, this advisory opinion isn't a lawsuit in itself, but it could shape how state courts need to look at climate change and understand it in terms of human rights. And this is something that's been led by the nation of Vanuatu, and really has the potential to uplift communities and uplift the connection between human rights and climate change. So that's something that's that has a lot of hope and potential in it. Also importantly to me, I also think that we're gonna see continued advances in the science. So we're going to be able to strengthen existing cases with new science, but also really inform new litigation as new science is emerging into this field. And again, this is an incredibly new area of research, and there's a lot of excitement for it. And there's a lot of ways for experts and scientists to get involved, to be working in this space. If you're an expert or a scientist and you're interested in this, please reach out to me and please sign up for the Science Hub. For our newsletter, if you just want to hear kind of what's happening in the realm of science and climate litigation. But now we've identified the gaps. We have kind of clear paths forward for doing some of this research, and I'm hopeful for some meaningful progress.
And what all of these legal actions are doing around the world is they're delegitimizing the ability of the fossil fuel industry to operate with the support of society. And so the more institutions you have cutting ties with the industry, the more legal efforts you have targeting the industry, the more you have the public waking up to the extent to which they've been lied to about this issue for years and years. That takes away a lot of the political cover that has shielded the industry from the types of regulations that would actually force it to make the changes we need to see. And in fact, that's the scenario that the oil and gas industry has been planning for and trying to stop for the last 40, 50, 60 years. And so I think we're at a really interesting moment where you could see a collapse in public opinion similar to what we saw around the tobacco companies.
Okay, well, I'd like to thank Jeff Dembicki for his book, also Alyssa Joel and Delta Myrna for their tireless work in fighting this injustice, building the scientific case, and helping get the oil companies to respond in court. Cambridge Forum is made possible through the generosity of Herbert and Dorothy Vetter, the Massachusetts Cultural Council, and of course you. So if you've got any spare change, feel free to donate it via the website, cambridgeforum.org. Thanks, everybody, for joining us today and enriching the discussion. And I hope to see you all soon.